If you look at the state bar rules, they've got an opinion on non-refundable retainers. It's not so non-refundable, oh, by the way. So one of the things we do, and probably the best example I can give you, is a consular processing case. You know, we break it up in parts. So if you want to pay me for the whole shebang, that's fine. I'm going to put it in my trust account, and I'm going to start with the I-130, and I'll take my fees for that I-130 out and transfer it to my operating account. What you never want to do is have to refund money from your operating account back to your client. And I know yesterday we had somebody who spoke on ethics, and I think one of the things that's important to tell you is, and this is from being at conferences with folks from, you know, the grievance committee and from the state bar, they will come after you for messing up on your IULTA. That's a guarantee. If you get popped for the IULTA, they're going to come after you, and they're going to come after you hard. Now, not returning calls, they really don't care that much about that. I mean, that's just the honest truth. You know, if you do it too much, they're going to slap you on the wrist. So I'm not telling you, hey, don't return your calls, because you should. You have an ethical responsibility to do that. But the one thing I guarantee you is if you mess with your trust account, they will come after you and come after you hard. You can lose your license for that. So, for instance, going back to the idea of the ConPro, sorry. You know, when we get to the waiver part of it, the I-601A, then we draw for that and so on and so on. And even the fees, if they bring me the money orders or whatever for the government, that has to go in your trust account. And then you cut it out of your trust account. So that, because the government fees are not yours. They don't belong to you. They don't belong to the client. They don't belong to the government until you write it out to the government. So anything that doesn't belong to you in terms of fees, that has to go into your trust account. And it doesn't belong to you until you've earned it. So part of the change in the practice today, if you're not doing this, you need to start doing this now. You know, anything you file, whether, and I heard Lakshmi talk about this, for instance, you file a standalone I-130, you need to add the bona fides evidence of the marriage to the I-130. It's almost an overkill in everything you do. You know, even you file, you know, if you file a motion for continuance, you better attach a bunch of evidence to it. You know, if you've got a waiver, I mean, those days, for those of us who are older, you know, it used to be at USCIS when you filed an I-601 waiver, basically you just gave them a statement, you know, one written affidavit, and you got a grant. Those days are long gone. I mean, you better put evidence like you were filing an I-601, you know, or an I-601A, you know, with you know, you not with your local office or whatever, but and also you're going to have to put a brief, because you're going to have to educate that adjudicator on your case. So it's going to be extra work, and that's just the new practice. That's just the new world. Mona, you had a couple other points?
Yes. So with the policy guidance for certain requests for evidence and notices of intent to deny, you know, the adjudicator has the full discretion to deny applications, petitions, or requests without first issuing a NOID or request for evidence when they think it's frivolous or substantially incomplete. As a result, following up with what George says, when you file, you need to make sure it's complete. One of the examples given is that when you file your I-485, you need to make sure that you include the I-864. So one of the things that have come up from this is that in the past, we have not been filing the I-693s with our adjustment package. The reason is because the I-693s were only good for 1 year. And since all 485s are being interviewed now, it's been taking quite a bit of time for the file to go to the local office for the interview to be conducted. So in the past, when we were called in for the interview, we would bring the I-693 at that time. But effective November 1st, I-693s will now be good for 2 years. In addition, they want the I-693 prepared within 60 days of filing. So since it's kind of ambiguous, we've made the decision in our firm that we're going to file all the I-693s with the I-485s from the get-go and no longer hold them and bring them to the interview. George, what are you all going to do in your practice?
We're just going to go ahead and file the medical exam now with all of our adjustment packets. But the other thing too that you know that we've been talking about this before we started our presentation and it's happening in my practice, things that are coming up are not new cases. Now we're dealing with stuff that we filed 2 years ago, 18 months ago. I've even got a client who filed for N-400 on her own. I adjusted her in 2002. And the problem is, and we'll talk about RFEs, but, you know, you almost have to read between the lines with the RFEs. You know, you read it and you go, oh, well, they want, you know, the I-130 where she was 245I. You know, read it again, you go, whoa, wait a minute. They're claiming she's not 245I. I had to go back. Thank God we still had the file.
Yes.
And it was a very convoluted, you know, I looked at it. We didn't even have a memo in the file about it, but I looked at it and I thought, oh, my God, we screwed up. And it turned out, no, you know, it was actually a brilliant move. Let me just say that.